Hey, I'm Kirk Harnack. On This Week in Radio Tech, Tom Ray, Chris Tarr, and Chris Tobin join me. We're talking about a couple of big developments. One was the shuttle flyby New York, and the other is Harris Corporation getting rid of the broadcast division. What does that mean for broadcasters? We'll talk about it on This Week in Radio Tech next.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is This Week in Radio Tech, episode 127, recorded May 2nd, 2012. Tune for Darkness. This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you by Axia and the new rack and desk consoles. Really affordable live wire consoles from Axia on the web at axiaaudio.com. It's time for This Week in Radio Tech. Hey there, I'm Kirk Harnack. I'm so glad that you are along for our podcast, your podcast too, because you should be in our chat room if you're not already at irc.twit.tv. This show is This Week in Radio Tech. It's the show where we talk about, well, all things radio tech. And if you're new to the show, well, you're going to find out that we talk about everything from microphones to the light bulb at the top of the tower and all the stuff in between that. And sometimes we get all philosophical and we talk about the industry and where things are headed and you know, what's ahead for broadcast engineers and those, you know, propeller heads like me and my co-hosts who are just into all this kind of stuff. Talk about audio and audio processing and audio delivery and all that kind of stuff. So let's bring in these guests, these mystery guests. My co-hosts on the show, we have, first of all, the best-dressed engineer in radio from Manhattan, New York. It's Chris Tobin. Hey, Chris.
Hello, Kirk. Hello, everyone. I'm a president at CCS Music Cam. We're an encoding codec company for disclosure purposes. And I've also spent about 25-plus years doing radio and some television. So I have plenty of stories and things that I've come across that we'll be sharing tonight.
Good deal. Also, another guest of ours from the Hudson Valley of New York, where he has his ham station and his ham shack and his children and his wife and his car that he had so much trouble getting HD into. It's your friend and mine, the everyman's engineer, Tom Ray. Hello, Tom.
Propeller head. I'm a jet fan head. Come on. And also in this lovely house, we have the refrigerator whose compressor died after 3 years. So, which is being replaced under warranty tomorrow. Not the compressor, the whole fridge, which is great. Anyway, I'm VP of Engineering for Buckley Broadcasting and WOR in New York. And glad to be here as always. And later on, after we introduce our next co-host, I got a couple of pictures to show you that are very cool.
All right, we'll get to those in just a minute. Our next co-host is this guy, the beer and cheese engineer, the beer and brats engineer, the beer and whatever beer goes with engineer. It's Chris Tarr from Muckwanago, Wisconsin. Hey, Chris.
Hey there. You got propeller heads, you got jet heads, and you've got cheese heads. Here you cheese go. Heads. I am the director of engineering for Intercom's radio stations in Milwaukee and Madison. Also a contributing writer for Radio Guide magazine and, oh, so many other things. Father of four, husband, you name it, I do it. There you go.
Apparently so, with four kids.
Yeah, well, you know, and they range the gamut, too. My oldest is 19 and my youngest is 4, so I don't sleep a lot.
Oh, my goodness. Wow. Well, I got you beat there. My oldest is 30 and my youngest is not 2 yet.
Mm-hmm. See, when you have, you know, they always say raising one child is difficult. You know, raising two is difficult. Then you've got a gang. I've got 4, so we're outnumbered 2-1.
Yes, so you are outnumbered.
It only takes, you know, one or two little things to turn that from a family into a revolution. And, you know, that happens. It's just, you know, bad things happen. That's when I go work on a transmitter site or something. I go, honey, great seeing you. Have fun. Gotta run.
Hey, sometime we ought to talk a bit more about your hobby of geocaching. That seems like a great thing to do with the kids, or at least the kids who are so inclined to go out geocaching.
Oh, yeah, my 11-year-old son and I have Team Tar, and we go out just about every weekend. And it's kind of funny because we can do, you know, we actually, and I won't take up too much time, but, you know, we can combine a lot of things. Like, you know, we also like to go look at radio towers and stuff, so we can go and do some tower hunting. But, in fact, I planted a cache by one of my tower sites out in the country along the road there. So we now have a site there for geocaching. So yeah, we love it a lot. We're up to 105 found now. So we usually go out every weekend and do that.
You know, if I was going to hide a cache, what would you think about putting it on a 10 kilowatt AM tower?
I would say that's probably not a good idea. It'd be fun to watch, but probably not a good idea.
Well, it turns out the cache was inside that ISO coupler.
Yeah. Talia disguised it as a tower light and it mounted halfway up the tower.
Yeah, it's inside the town, the obstruction lights. All right, we're going to get right to the show is brought to you by my friends, my employer, and I really appreciate these folks at Telos, Omnia, and Axia, also Linear Acoustic, the company now known as the Telos Alliance, and I appreciate the Axia division for sponsoring this show. I'm going to tell you about a couple of brand new consoles that were introduced at NAB during our break. We'll be getting to those shortly. Hey, Tom Ray, you've got a couple of interesting pictures that you want to show us. These are Kitty approved, yes?
Oh, of course. Okay. You know, people are always asking me, you know, gee, you work in New York City, isn't it a hassle getting in, getting out? And the answer to that question is always yes. and you're always at the whim of traffic. I mean, there are some mornings it takes me two and a half hours to get in. There's other mornings an hour and 20 minutes I'm sitting at my desk. It's you can't predict it. But you do get to see and do some cool things sometime. Bert, go ahead. We had the Space Shuttle Enterprise fly over New York City the other day on its way to the Intrepid, the SS Intrepid Museum. And actually, it landed over at Kennedy, JFK Airport. And it's going to be brought by barge over to the Intrepid probably in the next week or so. It was flying maybe 1,500 feet up. And it just glided over the city. They took it up the Hudson River, brought it up as far as the Tappan Zee Bridge, turned around, came back down, flew over the George Washington Bridge, kind of flew over Ground Zero, flew over the Intrepid.
Was it
flew
lost?
Flew over Lady Liberty. Yeah, well, no, they were seeing the sights. Okay. And then they landed the thing over at JFK. And it's funny because my wife said she saw the one that was delivered, I think it was to Texas. And that shuttle, she said, you know, had burn marks and was kind of beat up. This one here was used. It was never in space, but it was used as a prototype. They used it for glide tests. If they had to test something, they would do it on this shuttle. So it's in almost pristine condition. The thing was just gorgeous, and just to see that come over the over New York Harbor. I wanted to get Lady Liberty in the picture, but it was flying a little too close to the New York shore. It was absolutely incredible.
And then shortly after it landed, it got covered in graffiti, never to look the same again.
Well, that and got fitted for the subway, so we're all set. Yeah,
got tagged. Yeah, there you go.
So, Tom, did you take those pictures?
Yes, I did. I was I took a little walk. It's about I'm going to say about three blocks from the building on Broadway. We're down at the end of Manhattan, almost right down at the end of the island. And I went down to Battery Park and stood there because you can see the Statue of Liberty from that point, and you can see Ellis Island. The plane flew in. It flew up over Staten Island and came up over Lady Liberty and just went right up the Hudson River, and it was absolutely gorgeous.
What kind of camera and lens were you using there?
That was an older Minolta D'Image. I believe it's a 5i, which is a 5-megapixel camera. That's it. I mean, the thing was going. I mean, it was obviously it's probably going about 150, 200 miles an hour. It was moving, but it wasn't moving like a normal jet would be. Because it was moving almost as if it were on final approach. So it was plenty of time to focus, plenty of time to snap the shot, plenty of time to get a look and have the crowd ooh and ah and applaud after it went by.
Now, I've heard some people ask, hey, if a 747 can carry that big honking shuttle, why do they have to charge extra for bags?
Because very bluntly, they can.
They can. That's right. They can advertise a lower price online and then charge extra for the bags.
But you know it's amazing. The last time I saw a space shuttle was when we were on our honeymoon 25 years ago. We went to Kennedy Space Center as part of our trip down to Florida, and it was on the launch pad. You could get about 2 miles to it. They had a designated area. You got off the tour bus. you stayed in the designated area. If you went outside the designated area, they had people with large guns who would make sure you were put back into the designated area, maybe not in one piece. You know, at that point, it looks rather large. The fact that it sits on a 747, it's not that big. I mean, if you've been in a 747, it's surprising how small that space shuttle is. And down at Kennedy Space Center, they have things like the Apollo capsule, and they have a lunar lander there. And it's shocking to put your head inside one of those things and look around and go, my God, they spent how many days in space in this thing? It's just incredible. It was an incredible sight. Once in a lifetime, you'll never, ever see that again. So,
But you do have to wonder, what will we see in the future, if anything? Are we going to have to keep thumbing rides with the Russians to get to space? Or will we be doing something later on? I guess commercially, there will be something coming along. I'm not so sure that our government here in the U.S. is going to be doing any more big projects sending people
possibly,
to and from space.
Possibly not, but it would be interesting to actually take a little rocket ride to the moon just to, you know, say hi and come back. I mean, what the heck?
So does anybody know much about the big fairing on the back of the shuttle when they load on the 747? You know, the engine nozzles are all covered by what Titus in the chat room says, is that a diaper on the back of the shuttle? It's for aerodynamics. But it really, you know, if you have the back end of the nozzles there, that's a ton of drag, a bunch of vacuum formed there when you're flying along at, 200, 300 knots.
Well, and so if you look at the tail on the plane, you'll notice they modified the ailerons on the tail too.
Yeah, the vertical rudders. Can't think of the right name for it, but yeah, they sure did because the rudder may be in a modified slipstream, you know, a turbulent slipstream behind the shuttle. So they had to put some little rudders out at the ends of the elevator. Wow. Well, that had to be a cool sight. Did you have notice? Vertical stabilizers. Okay, thank you. Did you have notice of this happening, Tom?
It was interesting because, you would think there would have been a huge crowd, and there wasn't. And the reason being, I believe it was canceled twice because of the weather. And we knew about it that morning. It was part of the news stories. The TV stations the TV networks were going to cover it from the time they took off down in Washington, D.C. We knew about it. We had an idea of the flight path, we knew it was going to go up the Hudson. And if it was going to go up the Hudson, therefore, I knew I was going to be able to see it from down in Battery Park because they specified it was going to fly over the Statue of Liberty. They specified Ground Zero, and that's all down towards our end of our end of Manhattan. And also the Intrepid is on the west side, so made a lot of sense that they flew all the way up the Hudson River.
Wow, that had to be a cool sight. Thanks for sharing that with us. I appreciate it. Did WOR and other news stations do some kind of radio coverage for that arrival?
We really didn't do much because it arrived over at JFK, but there was a lot of television coverage when it came in. You know, there were some speeches. Leonard Nimoy, believe it or not, Leonard Nimoy was on hand because it's the Enterprise. There were some people. I believe we had our news director was on the deck of the Intrepid. He was actually on cell phone. I told him, here, take the Comrex access, but no, he just wanted to grab his cell phone. So, because it was a quick bit, it was going to be a quick flyover. And it's funny, from New York Harbor up to the Tappan Zee Bridge, I'm going to say is probably 25 miles, maybe 30. They flew from the Statue of Liberty up to Tappan Zee and came back down. It was less than 20 minutes. Just whoosh, up and around and down around New York Harbor and over to JFK. So,
well, that's what planes are for. They're for getting there fast. No surprise there. So, hey, guys.
And you know what's interesting, too, is you don't see many planes flying over Manhattan these days because they're not supposed to fly over Manhattan after 9/11 happened. So, it was just real interesting to see it and a lot of fun. So you do get to see some cool things in New York. So sometimes it's really worthwhile to go in.
Now, by the way, Tom, I know that I've been on several flights from Nashville, landing typically at LaGuardia, where we are on a right base for LaGuardia, and we're over Manhattan. I mean, even after 9/11, I've looked out the window and right there's the Empire State Building.
Well, yeah, so but you're north of the Empire State Building. You're not down towards the center of the island anymore. The LaGuardia flight path is more up towards the George Washington Bridge, which is around 180th Street. So,
gotcha. Okay. Well, hey, we're here to talk about radio stuff. So that was a great sidebar. But let's turn our attention to radio. And the big story this week in the radio business, all of us have probably worked on Harris transmitters for years, bought them, installed them, rarely decommissioned them, but probably still have some going here and there. And the Harris Corporation announced this week that they will sell their broadcast business. Now, turns out Harris is a big company, and the broadcast division is really not that big a part of the overall company. Here, I'll give you a couple sentences. This out of Radio World Online, an article written by Paul McLean. The decision, this is a quote here from William Brown, president and CEO of Harris. The decision to divest the broadcast communications division resulted from a thorough review of our business portfolio, which determined that the business is no longer aligned with the company's long-term strategy. News came yesterday, and the company released its latest financial numbers yesterday morning. The plan to sell these assets supports our disciplined approach, and this sounds like CEO talk, and it is, to capital allocation, and we intend to use the proceeds to return cash to shareholders and invest in growing our core business. Now there's some things about this, and maybe, Tobin, maybe you can comment on some of these numbers. They said they were going to have like a $400-something million write-down in their books for this quarter or this half of the year. And they, let's see. Oh, I thought I had a figure as to what it might be for sale. For some reason, $150 million sticks in my head, but that might be something I made up.
Yeah. There was some talk of it being $200 million. Several years ago, there was talk of them selling off this division. And at the time, the division was reportedly bringing in around $600-plus million, which in the scope of things for the Harris Corporation is, yes, peanuts. Their primary business is military, government, secure communications, and some black ops type stuff. So it's no surprise. But, it's sad because some of their reasoning I read in some of the articles is because of for cost, and it makes you wonder whether or not is it really does it cost more for them to get rid of it, or maybe they just need to rethink how they're using it, because they're also getting rid of their cyber integrated solutions business unit as well. So these are two divisions that are part of their integrated network solutions group. So I'm curious as to where they're trying to go with their core, since their military stuff is also sort of going to be going down a bit, because the military spending is on the decline at the moment. The budget cuts have changed a lot.
I'm a little confused here, and maybe you guys can help me understand this. Okay, the broadcast division has in recent years not performed the way that the corporation wants. Okay, broadcast is not a huge growing division, but if you were at NAB and you went to the Harris booth, mostly television stuff, but they had a radio part of that too, brimming with people. I mean, that they were busy at the Harris booth. So, as a going broadcast manufacturing concern, Harris looks to me like, I mean, they've got I don't know how all honey and roses that it is, but they certainly had plenty of interest at their booth.
Go ahead, Chris. Go ahead.
I was going to say, I don't know that it's that's a problem. I'm not certain that the whole reason for dumping this is that it was performing horribly or that they're losing money. But let's face it. I mean, here's the profit margins in broadcast equipment have gotten slimmer and slimmer and slimmer. And that's not, although the government contract work is also slowed down, there's still a much higher profit margin there. And I think what you're seeing is that, it got to the point where it just, they're putting a lot of resources into the broadcast division that really didn't, pay back a whole lot of money. Now, back when that was their core business, as well as doing all the broadcast, ancillary equipment and things like that, it made a little more sense. Nowadays, it really is secondary to the government work that they're doing. And because the margins aren't as big as they used to be, they're cutting corners and things like that. And I also think they wanted to wait because, with AVSB and the whole DTV thing, that was a huge thing for them the past few years. Everybody had to upgrade their transmitters for the transition. That's done. So now every TV station pretty much has brand new transmitters, so they're not going to be customers anytime soon. And, you know, there's really been no incentive for radio with the economy being slow for picking that up. So I just think it was, you know, like Chris Tobin said, I mean, I think we've all seen the writing on that wall for years. And, you know, it is kind of a passing. I hope somebody will pick it up and keep it. I went to Quincy many times. In fact, I went through they used to run a training program there for engineering and transmitters. Yeah. I went through 2 or 3 years their training and, you know, spent a lot of time in Quincy with them. So it's kind of sad to see it go, but I don't think anybody's surprised.
And as far as it goes, it's not going. It's not. I mean, it's not going anywhere. You're still going to have Harris transmitters available. In fact, looking at Paul McLean's blog here, where he writes his thoughts about this sale, Paul says Harris officials tell us today that their business remains sound, and this is the broadcast division, that the company is in a good position, that there are no changes in management or employee levels. For now, the only real change is that the broadcast division will report its fourth quarter earnings separately. The planned sale, they emphasize, came about because broadcast no longer fits into the big company's long-term vision. I'm sorry, I jumped right on somebody else. Was that?
Chris New York. Yeah, I was going to dovetail on what Chris Tarr was saying, that part of, I think, what we're seeing. And on the previous show, Triangulation, I think it was Bill Harris's name. What's happening is you have a lot of companies now, they're looking at strictly, numbers in the sense of, say, think of Kodak. Kodak is, filed bankruptcy. They have their issues. They're back. They're pretty much a patent portfolio company. There's nothing going on. Reason being that their old model, I shouldn't say old, their business model was based on such an industry where the numbers were so high and so great. Grand that when it came to digital and evolving to something new, the numbers were smaller. And to quote Bill Harris in the last show, it's like you have this big ship hull and then you have a barnacle stuck on the side, which is now the digital or the new evolution. And it just doesn't know where to go and what to do. And it's still a barnacle no matter how you look at it, even though it is growing or is producing something. I think what's happened with Harris, they look at the broadcast group. Yes, it's viable. It's still, people come to the booth. They still sell product. 60% of the industry still uses Harris or recognizes the name if you do any kind of polls. But I think people are just looking at it like, well, it's old. It's something different. We're not, we just don't have time for it anymore. And it's a shame. It shouldn't look like that. It shouldn't be the way to go. But moving forward to today, this, current times, if you've read some of the earlier articles and some other trades, some of the competitors, though, have been displacing Harris products in many, stalwart, facilities that have been, Harris plants for eons. So, that too may have played a part, and they may have decided maybe it's time to just put it off to the side, let it produce its own numbers. If you're interested in buying it, here's what it can do, 10 times, 15 times multiple, have fun.
Well, I mean, look at, 20 years ago, Harris was the Cadillac of transmitters. I mean,
absolutely.
If you were going to buy a transmitter and you were going to buy a real high quality transmitter, you bought Harris. And over the years, they had some internal struggles. I think there was a while there, early 2000s, where they were kind of trying to find their way with what they wanted to do. Were they going to do broadcasts? They were just starting to get into military communications. They made a bunch of changes. They kind of floated for a little while. In fact, financially, they were kind of hurting a little bit. And then they righted the ship and focused more on the industrial and military. But, let's be honest, some of the customer service has suffered. They kind of lost some of that innovation they had. And you kind of alluded to this, Chris, companies like Nautel, now opening up shop at Quincy, became much more attractive even to some of their employees and some of their customers. And, and BE has done a fantastic job of staying ahead of that as well. So I think you're seeing the pure play players like the Nautels and the BEs and the Continentals really kind of stepping in that vacuum that Harris kind of left when they decided to shift their focus.
Absolutely. I mean, that's definitely one of I'm sure it's one of the reasons why we're seeing the shift in what's going on. Because I can say in the years past when I was looking at some transmitter replacements, Harris was on the list. But when we started looking, at the specs and really getting into the technologies, believe it or not, they were not on top. And, it was a shame because, you have a plant full of Harris parts already. It would be nice to keep going that direction, but we just couldn't do it. And I think their competitors, as you point out, Nautel, BE, and a few others, Continental, just saw the writing on the wall and realized if we don't step in now, you know, nobody will get what they want. And I have to say, I've installed a couple of Nortel transmitters. And you know what? You know, 20 years ago, 15 years ago, Nortel was in the same boat Harris was in. They didn't know where they were going, what they were doing. And now they've turned around and, you know, it's amazing what's going on. I think BE is in the same position now with their transmitters.
You know, some folks are commenting that that BE is a bit of a weakened company at the moment, that they're not really sure about their way. I don't know if that's true or not. I know some folks who work for BE and at Telos we not too long ago hired a gentleman who left BE, so it looks like BE may have kind of run out of innovation. Not saying they have. It just kind of looks that way as a customer. Harris certainly has had a lot of innovation. We spoke briefly with Jeff Mendenhall of Harris Broadcast Division at the ham radio reception from NAB. And Jeff was talking about their Flexiva transmitter and how they're using these semiconductors they've been using in their TV transmitters for a little while, but getting a lot of power out of a small amount of space. And I know that with people like Jeff Mendenhall on board at Harris, there's got to be innovation still happening there. But you're right, Harris probably picked up the gravy train of transmitter sales, at least in the radio and television business. Radio with HD for the past few years, and television with ATSC in the past few years, they've picked up a lot of sales, and now a lot of those are satisfied. They've dropped off. Demand is lower, and then you've got a company with a single focus like Nortel that does seem to be making a lot of sales in places where I'm sure Harris or BE would have liked to. So, what do you think? I mean, would it make sense for some investor, some company to purchase both BE and Harris and merge the product lines? By the way, I should point out that that Nortel was recently sold. It was recently picked up by some investors in Halifax, Nova Scotia, where they're based. That wasn't the same sort of transfer as Harris Corporation getting out of the broadcast business, but still, it seems like there's. There was a change recently, and a change in ownership desired, apparently, by the folks at Harris. Go ahead.
I was going to say, I think you're right. I think there's certainly the possibility of some sort of merger there. You look at like a Continental Electronics. They certainly could broaden their horizons a little bit. I hope for the best. It's kind of funny as I sit here doing what I'm doing now. As a young guy in the business, Harris was the place. I always talked about how, one of the jobs I'd love to do down the road is, sell or work for a company like Harris, doing transmitter stuff. And I think there's still a bright future. You're right. There's still a lot of people there who innovate. I think that once those people are kind of released from the burden of having to be part of this company that is kind of not focused on that, I think that there are some. I think we'll see some really interesting things happen, but I do think that there is the industry is ripe for a little consolidation there, with Nortel, BE, Harris, Continental. I think you might see one of those players at least ask some questions.
So, in the grand scheme of things, if you take a look at Harris's numbers, for a company like Harris. Yeah, okay, the broadcast division, it's peanuts, but they've got respectable numbers. I don't see why someone wouldn't pick them up. It's an old established company. They've got some very great they've got some good products. They've got a lot of great people. I don't see why someone either wouldn't pick them up independently or, like Chris Tarr was saying, merge. I think it would be a great thing. It'll be interesting to see what happens. It'll be interesting to see the innovation that comes out.
If I have a Harris transmitter, not one of real old vintage, because my understanding is that they've dropped support for a lot of older products, including I think they've dropped support for most, if not all, of the PR&E digital consoles and products that when they bought PR&E some years ago. They have a current line of consoles. But if I have a Harris transmitter, should I be worried about support? I'm guessing not, but what do you guys think?
No, I wouldn't worry.
I don't think so.
Yeah, I don't see that happening.
No, I think what'll happen.
Go ahead,
Tom.
Oh, and I was going to say, a couple people I've talked to didn't really seem to be all that worried. I'm talking sales and, otherwise at Harris, and they were all pretty calm about it. If they're calm about it, and these are the workers who could stand to lose their jobs, I mean, really, why should I be worried?
Yeah, I think the best thing that could happen for Harris, for the broadcast group, I mean, I've met a lot of them, and we've all been out to Quincy at least once or twice, if not more, and I've been out to the folks in San Diego for the consoles, and they're very good people. They know what they're doing. I think if they come out from underneath the umbrella of the large corporation, it has other goals in mind, then with the talented folks that there are and staff both in Quincy and elsewhere throughout the broadcast group, the right persons or investors that take over, first of all, you have a customer base that's mature, that's the largest going right now. That's an area right there where revenue can come in from support and things of that nature. Then you have whatever technologies or innovations that are sitting on a whiteboard somewhere in an office that hasn't seen the light of day because the larger corporation wasn't interested in funding it. Now you have a group of people who are interested and go, hey, you have what? It could do what to the industry? How does this dovetail with the products we have now? Someone who's smart about it looks at it, and if you just do the numbers only, sure, it's going to fail because the numbers aren't going to be in the favor of what people want. But if you look at it from an industry standpoint and say, wait a minute, if this is what I have in the industry, this, we'll say 60% are Harris transmitters, or say maybe 70%. And let's talk about digital television. Right now, DTV, mobile DTV, and everything else is growing and evolving. The second screen is coming out, over-the-top video. Harris has got their fingers into all this stuff because they also make video equipment. So, matter of fact, if you've watched any of these sports networks like MSG or YES Networks or ESPN, half that video stuff is handled by a Harris NV switches. So, they have the infrastructure. They have a lot. It's just going to require somebody that says, okay, where are we in the business? What? Where are our tentacles? Are we really maximizing this stuff? And that's when you see something come of it.
Well, I think that leads me to another point, which, as much as I hate to say it, it's true. Think about the patent library you're going to get with that. I mean, look at all the, over the years and all the things that Harris has come up with. I mean, you're going to... all that intellectual property, somebody's going to have. And I think that's valuable just by itself.
Absolutely. So who wants to take a guess at this bit of trivia? How many years old is the Harris Corporation? Anybody know when it was started?
You're talking the broadcast division?
No, the Harris Corporation, the company that started back way back when.
Harris or Gates?
Harris. Yeah, Harris or Gates.
Harris
would Harris be like 1890. I think it was 1895.
Yes. You looking at Wikipedia? Yes.
I wasn't looking at Wikipedia. Did you see?
Really?
Answer there at the top of my head. Yeah.
1895 is when it was the Harris Automatic Press Company, founded in Niles, Ohio, back in 1895. They spent 60 years developing lithographic presses, printing presses, and then they acquired the Intertype Corporation. So then it became Harris Intertype Corp. And they acquired Gates Radio. I was looking over. By the way, Mr. Harris, who started the company, Alfred S. Harris, he was the president of the company for 52 years. He was the president of the company for 52 years. Crying out loud. How old was he when he quit?
Man. One of the most successful years of the company.
They were?
I'm just saying.
Oh, okay.
It's old school.
So I'm looking at different companies. I'm trying to figure out, okay, last quarter, their revenue was something like $1.48 billion in a quarter. Okay? That's a lot. So... what are some of the companies that they've acquired in the last 10, 12 years? Remember back in just before 2000, in 1999, they acquired Audio Broadcast Group. Remember ABG? They used to sell broadcast gear up in the north. Anybody remember ABG? No?
Yep.
Okay. They acquired, is it Louth Automation or Louth Automation?
Louth.
They acquired Lucent Technologies' point-to-point microwave business back in 2000. They acquired a company called Wavetrace. They acquired Exigent International. They acquired Hirschman Multimedia, ImageLynx, Encoda, Oakland. Here's a big one. They for the broadcast division anyway, they acquired Leech technology, video and audio routing switching. Optimal Solutions, Astra Digital Video, a company called Multimax, Xander Technologies, Crucial Security. They acquired Tyco Electronics Wireless Systems in 2009. Sola, Signacern, Caprock. They acquired Schlumberger Global Communication Services Division in 2011, and a company called CareFX. I mean, they've acquired. Oh, and back in 99, they also acquired PR&E, as broadcasters are very familiar with Pacific Research and Engineering Corporation.
And Interplex. Also,
and Interplex in 99 as well. So quite a few broadcast-related acquisitions just before the turn of the century in 1999. Northeast Broadcast Lab, they also bought in 97. So, man, they acquired a lot of their acquisitions were broadcast-related. And yet, I'm sorry, I still haven't seen the breakout. How do they get $1.48 billion of business in a quarter? Is this our tax dollars at work? Are they selling stuff to the U.S. government?
It's government contracts.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, you should government see. I mean, they're very big in the infrastructure for two-way communication. Open Sky, I believe, is Harris. Municipal stuff. I mean, they're very, very big into that. In fact, it was kind of weird. A friend of mine does two-way work, walking into one of his sites and seeing an Interplex sitting there. You know, it's all that stuff is now.
You guys were talking about patents, and it reminded me of a gentleman who used to work for Harris. He started out working for Collins Radio in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, and then in Continental in Dallas. Hilmer Swanson. Remember that name, Hilmer Swanson?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He has a number of patents in the in high-efficiency amplitude modulation. I'm sure Harris has those patents, so that'll be part of Hilmer's inventions led to the first commercial implementation of PDM, pulse duration modulation, one of the methods of getting high levels of amplitude modulation. So, pretty cool. And according to this article, Swanson's patents led to AM transmitters being a solid state and made vacuum tube AM transmitters pretty much obsolete. Does that sound about right?
Yep.
That's right. To my knowledge, didn't Harris have the first solid state AM transmitter with the MW1?
Correct. Yes, that was the first foray. Yep.
Yep.
But that one wasn't PDM modulation. That was a kind of progressive series modulation, if I recall.
It had a pulse train. It was a PDM based. Yeah.
Oh, really?
It was just that the transistors in each module had to be properly matched, otherwise. The switching duty cycle, if it wasn't just right, the beta of the transistors would blow out a module. That I do recall from having an MW1.
That and if you didn't have the tuning exactly right in the combiner stage where all the modules combined, you'd just start blowing transistors right and left. But they ran, boy, let me tell you, they ran.
They ran great. Yeah. They had the light bulbs in the RF cavity were not for display, but more for proper tuning or duty cycle of each module. If the light bulbs were coming on, that meant that they were not turning on and off properly.
Yep. The idea was to keep the light bulbs off.
Right. Hey, tune for darkness.
Tune for darkness. All right. Well, guys, we're going to continue our conversation with some of the topics of the day. Coming up, we are going to touch on some cool apps for engineers, also from the pages of Radio World. We'll talk about fines, FCC fines, and what they really mean for broadcasters. Are they a reason to keep things right as rain, or just a cost of doing business? And we'll talk about, I'm sure, a couple other things as well coming up. Right now, though, I want to thank our sponsor, which is Axia Audio. And this week's sponsor is the new Little Consoles series from Axia. The Rack, the RAQ, isn't that cute? Kind of sounds like an IKEA name, huh? The Rack and the Desk, DESQ. Burke, can you find those and throw them up on the screen? There should be a page on the Axia. There we go. Look, that man is holding. He's holding a console in his very hands. The Rack and the Desk consoles from Axia. These were just introduced at the NAB. And, at least one of them, I think it was the Rack, got a couple of awards from the two different publications that give those out. These consoles are small. They're very affordable. I think under $5,000 is the list price for either one of these console services, plus the rack mount portion, which is called the Core, and that's spelled Q-O-R, also IKEA-esque, the Core 16. So that's got a variety of inputs and outputs for the console, plus the built-in Ethernet switch on the, oh, there it is. There's a nice picture. Yeah. The built-in Ethernet switch on the back of the console, and mic inputs, analog inputs and outputs, AES. There's one AES input and one AES output, and there's that built-in Ethernet switch on the back. That Ethernet switch does have a couple of, I'm sorry, has one gigabit port, and it also has an SFP port. So if you want to go to a fiber optic link out of there and onto a different studio or to a core switch somewhere, you can certainly do that. It also has some ports that are PoE, power over Ethernet. So you can take an accessory that's powered over PoE and plug it right into it. Did I ever get a longer cable for this? I guess I didn't. Like this phone right here. The, you know, I'm not a very good showman if I can't show this off, am I? What I'm getting at is the rack or the desk console can power this phone, this pretty phone that I can't quite show you from Telos. Also, it can power our new nodes, the new X node series from Telos, which gives you more mic inputs or line level or AES inputs. Here you can see how you might set up two studios because a single Core 16 engine can actually power two surfaces. So you can get a desk console and a rack and put them in different studios. You could put them in the same studio if you wanted to. You can get two desk consoles or two rack consoles. And so you can run two studio control surfaces off of one Core 16 engine, including two sets of independently controlled monitor speakers, headphones, and even a phone system or two if you'd like. Check it out on the website at axiaaudio.com and go find you the link for the rack and the desk. There you go. You can click on the picture or click on the link, and there you go. Your favorite Axia dealer should have those available, if not already, just any day now. Part of the line that's live wire enabled. Just plug it right into any live wire network. It'll talk to all the other stuff on the network, the rack and the desk. Thanks very much, Axia Audio, for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech. So we've been talking about this announcement that Harris Corporation wants to divest itself of the broadcast division. And the broadcast division is near and dear to our hearts. For years ago in my career as a broadcast engineer, my Harris sales rep would call me up about once a year, says, Kirk, I'm going to be in Richmond, Kentucky, or Lexington, Kentucky, or Memphis, Tennessee. Would you like to have breakfast? For some reason, I was always the breakfast guy. Does that mean I was less important than the dinner guy? I don't know, but maybe so. But I would always have breakfast with the Harris sales rep. I'd look at the whatever transmitters they had whatever accessories, AM mod monitors, FM mod monitors that they may be offering. I don't know. Are those days still around? Chris, Tom, Chris Tarr?
I would say for some folks, they're still around. But you're right. In the days of old, a lot of the sales guys did that. I mean, those of us in the Northeast and Massachusetts, Connecticut, New York, remember a gentleman by the name of Art Silver, and with the Harris
Art
folks.
Art was a true gentleman and a great guy. Great guy.
Yeah, and he would he would pop into town and do the same thing, offer breakfast or lunch. And there was another gentleman who was a chief engineer of a radio station here in New York City for many years, who went to work for several different distributors and finally with Harris. His name is Doc Masumian, and those of us in the New York City, I remember Doc. He, too, would travel and call up and say, hey, I'm in town. Let's get together for lunch or dinner or breakfast. And I'm not here to sell you anything. Just letting you know what's going on and good to keep in touch. I don't know too many places, too many salespeople that are encouraged to do that anymore. There was a few folks at SCMS that used to do that. I haven't checked in with them lately. But, it's a lost art, I think, in sales and customer support or reaching out to customers. People don't do it anymore.
So, Harris, at some point, acquired Allied, right? And Allied was a company based out of Richmond, Indiana, that sold broadcast equipment. They were called generally a box company. If you wanted to buy a turntable or a CD player or a cassette deck or a console, Allied, we get that for you. Well, Harris bought Allied and brought all that box business in-house at Harris. One time I had to visit Harris in Quincy, but I visited them in just north of Cincinnati in Mason, Ohio, and they had a huge warehouse full of boxed goods. A lot of Omnia processors, for example, a lot of Telos gear, too. They were at one point a big, big dealer for my employer, Telos and Omnia, and not never for Axia, but for Telos and Omnia. They sold that business. They sold that whole box good business off to SCMS. So that's a very popular broadcast equipment dealer on the East Coast of the U.S. So SCMS, you know, acquired all of that business. So, of course, Harris still was direct selling and through some dealers around the world, transmitters and also audio routing and console mixing. I was just I was just on the Harris website looking at their transmitter solutions. And I had forgotten that, you know, Harris is very much a worldwide player, and their broadcast division is no exception. So they make transmitters for DMB transmission, DRM transmitters. They make radio STL contribution and distribution solutions. It's been a while since I've bought a Harris transmitter, not being so much in the broadcast business myself anymore. I own a few radio stations, but they're already equipped at the moment. Guys, what was you know, other than a transmitter, have any of you been using some Harris gear, like Intraplex gear, now branded Harris?
Oh, yeah. We've got Intraplex stuff at WR. STL transmitters. We don't have any, but they did make STL transmitters. Let's see, Harris. Well, I've used Harris consoles and Gates consoles when they were Gates consoles. It used to be able to go to Harris / Gates and equip the whole radio station. You know, make one phone call, get off the phone, and they were there. So.
Yeah, I've used their Intraplex products.
Yeah, and I've seen a lot of Harris tuning networks and phasers for AM, and they used to have ERI antennas that were branded as Harris antennas. And it for those of us who kind of grew up in the industry, Harris used to be it.
How did Harris earn the name, the nickname, maybe a pejorative, Quincy Tin Works? What's that about?
It's probably from where they manufacture the transmitters. You know, it's a little metalwork.
Don't they make all their own cabinets, Chris?
Yes, they do. They make their own cabinets as well.
The story behind that is when Intertie, when Harris bought Quincy, or when Harris bought Gates, and I think it was oldradio.com has a story about that, and they stopped manufacturing because Gates had very ornate rounded corners and, you know, a very, very nice, thick, substantial cabinets to their transmitters. And then after Harris bought them, they went on a big cost kind of measurement program. And one of the first things to go is the design of the cabinets, and they went to more standard components and standard sizes. And my understanding is that's when the Quincy Tin Works moniker came around.
That makes sense. And then you see that's why Harris is in the boat they're in now. See?
There you go.
They weren't paying attention to the end user. They weren't thinking about the customer.
You know, I always figured that Harris must own stock in a company that makes little screws and washers and lock washers.
Oh, Lord.
Because
it
seems like no matter what Harris product I worked on, oh my goodness, there were so many, and I'm glad they used them, but it seemed like very little was ever maybe welded together, or I don't know. You know, there's all kinds of ways to design stuff, metal that you bend and gotta, you know, make it stick together. But man, the screws, holy cow, screws and screws and screws and more screws.
Well, remember a while back, right now, if they make a modification, or if there's a service bulletin on the transmitter, you find it on their website. But remember years ago when all of a sudden a box would just appear from Harris, you'd open it up, there'd be a service bulletin in there and all the parts you needed to make the modification?
Yes.
And
I always got to wonder how they decided. I mean, a company that big with that many transmitters out there, it seems like the lawyers have got to be involved. And I remember getting for like a Harris MW, I want to say an MW, not an MW, an SX, an SX 2.5. I worked at a station that had two of them, one for the day site and one for the night transmitter site. These were AM transmitters, PDM. Thank you, Hilmer. And they sent us two kits of parts for these transmitters. And I think the implication of the documentation was, if you don't replace these parts, we will not be responsible if the thing catches on fire.
But yeah, they did that with the MW5 to a point.
MW5 had that.
Yeah, it was a, let's see, if I remember it correctly, it was a fiberglass tube that you had to install on a standoff off the plate transformer, and the high voltage wiring ended up going through that, because what was happening with the high voltage wiring, it was brushing up against the transformer, and the hot transformer would eventually break down the insulation, and there'd be a big bang. So I remember getting this thing, and there was a postcard you had to send back. You know, this is the days before the internet. And I remember getting a nasty gram like a month later saying, you know, you haven't sent your postcard back. Call us now.
they wanted to make sure it was done.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I recall Harris being, I may be wrong here, but my impression was that Harris has been a leader in safety in designing their transmitters, in making sure that you can't hurt yourself in normal use and normal proper maintenance of the transmitter. I remember that Harris was the first transmitter that I ever saw that had, you know, the international warning labels, you know, the one with the guy's finger that's kind of cut off by a pulley and a belt, right? And then their metal pieces that had the right size hole, kind of a square but with convex portions of it, you can't get your finger through it. And they, in fact, I was at the Harris factory years ago, and they showed me the finger that they use to test, and they'll poke it around everywhere and make sure that they haven't missed anything, that you can't poke a finger through their product when all the doors are on or stuff, or even if the outer doors are pulled open, that you couldn't hurt yourself on their product. Am I right that they were probably at the leading edge of making sure they were following all the rules, especially OSHA rules about safety?
Oh, I would say most of the transmitters had safety components, but I think that was also part of their ISO 9000 certification back in the early days for manufacturing too.
Okay.
They went to great lengths. I will say that their manuals, the binders, had a section on safety, was the first chapter, even the older books. Matter of fact, I think, probably from the beginning. And yes, most of their transmitters, at least I can speak for when I've worked on them, you could open the cover, the door, the front door, the back, rear door, or any part of it, there was always some type of safety device mechanism, whether a plexiglass cover or some kind of hood over a component to prevent you from accidentally hurting yourself. Again, if you defeated these safety features, all bets were off. But yeah, I would say Harris Transmit was probably one of the most prominent. You definitely saw it. It wasn't by accident. It wasn't hidden. It wasn't like, oh, that's convenient. It was quite clear and right up front. Hey, this is a safety mechanism. Don't try to change it unless you understand what's going on.
Well, after meeting Jeff Mendenhall at the Ham Show, I did corner him, and he agreed to appear on our show. And I'd just love to pick his brain about some of the tech that he's been working on. If for those of you in the audience who are not familiar with Jeff or Jeffrey Mendenhall, Jeff used to work for BE quite some time ago. And I remember some of my early education into FM transmitters was reading some, white papers, some pamphlets that Jeff Mendenhall had written. Now, Jeff works at Harris now, and he has worked there for quite some time. But man, this guy is able to take really complex ideas and put them into a white paper format that, you know, if you look over it and read it, you're going to understand it, and you're going to understand it at a very high level. Where that I would say it was because of Jeff's papers from BE that I gained a real understanding of how the FM baseband works and all the different ways you can screw it up that you can make it not work so well, and what's important about keeping it pristine. And so I think that kind of communication level, I'm looking forward to having Jeff on the show and maybe teaching us a few things about what's been happening in the last few years with especially RF technology. So I guess sound good to you guys?
It sounds good, and he's very personable. He's a very nice guy. You know, he's just a lot of fun to talk to. You learn a lot. He's just a great guy. He takes an interest in you, and he's got you all of a sudden find out you've got a lot of things in common with him. And the funny thing was, when we put the MDCL on the WR transmitters back in October, we popped a couple of amplifier modules, and he was kind of looking at them lovingly and salivating, and I handed him the soldering iron and said, here you go, Jeff, you want to fix them? And he said, could I? Yeah. So I can honestly say that Jeff Mendenhall fixed one of my transmitters.
A great story. Could I? Oh, that's terrific. Yeah, well, just a short time talking to Jeff. I believe what you say. It sounds entirely true. Hey, Burke, have you got ready the webpage that I sent you in the chat room? This is, once again, my drawing from my favorite pages in the online version of Radio World magazine. This is just came out yesterday. Apps, apps, and more apps. And I'm really loving some of these apps here. There we go. The first one, apps for engineers. This is a... this suggestion comes in from Marvin Walther, chief engineer of Carroll Broadcasting in Ottawa City, Michigan. And he's talking about this app called GPS Essentials for Android. And it's free. And it gives you just a good readout of a number of different things you can determine from GPS. Well, okay, battery level, sure. But including your exact time and your altitude and even the accuracy, moon phase. Anyway. There you go. GPS Essentials. I love to look at stuff that kind of gives you some GPS inner workings. What really caught my eye, though, was this next app, and I want to ask you guys about this. You know, we've kind of some of us have gotten away from a traditional oscilloscope. You know, oscilloscopes used to be this deep, right? And now even high-quality scopes are much, much less deep now, and they have an LCD display or even an output to a PC. But for $300, $400, maybe $200, I got something from Pico, I think Pico Instruments, that is an oscilloscope. It's not highly, highly accurate. I think it's only an 8-bit sampling, but it'll show you FM baseband. It'll let me do educational demonstrations of FM baseband because it also does a spectrum analysis, and the output goes to your PC. Now, there's an application, I think it's only Windows, at least the version I have, it only has a Windows app, but there's an application for the PC that you bring the data in to the PC through the USB, and voila, on your laptop, you're looking at an oscilloscope display. Well, here you have on the screen a digital multimeter for iOS devices. Paul Brown of KVIP Radio in Redding, California says, one app for the iPhone that I don't think you have covered is the iDVM by Redfish Instruments. Uses the phone as the display and interfaces to a wireless remote AD converter box. Woo! Hey, if it's wireless, that means you could put it into a real high voltage situation, right? And not have to worry about it touching ground or something. There's a free demo, and Paul says it's on his wish list. But look at that pretty DVM display on the iPhone there. Do you guys have anything like this?
No, not for DVM. Really cool. I used a Zelscope for a laptop. The Zelscope was a software that you could create an oscilloscope pattern on your laptop or computer using a high quality sound card. That worked out really well. That works really nice. But not this one. Not the iPhone app. Not yet. No.
Well, that looks like fun. And the I'm going to slip on down here to the next one that's got a picture, Burke, from Nick Markowitz with Markowitz Electric and Integration in Verona, Pennsylvania. This kind of a multi app here. I'm sorry, four apps here. Resistor color code. If you can't remember the naughty sentence to remember the colors, then you can use this. There's an Ohm's law calculator and a capacitance calculator there, and an op amp calculator. So that's pretty cool. Anyway, that actually was the eye slipstick. And then the last one there, Nick Markowitz mentioned a number of apps that he finds useful. One for finding metric wire gauge converters, engineering cookbook, Electrodroid, and Electronica by Hacksoft Developments. Great pinout scales and other useful tools. And some RF tools by KubeCAD. Also, ToneDef. That's a good word. ToneDef by Hacksoft Developments. Good tool for modems, RF, and microwaves. So anyway. Ooh, look at that. Burke, what are we looking at?
That is my pocket oscilloscope.
Oh, cool. Does it have any probes, or is it just showing you some? Oh.
They're hidden.
Oh, okay, gotcha.
But
gotcha.
Yeah, it's two channel. It's not bad. For it's less than $200.
You know, really?
It's kind of limited, but for the price, it's nice. You can take screenshots.
It makes actually, me long for the days of aligning heads.
On, even.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool.
It's by, which brand is that?
There we go.
Digital what brand storage, is that? Doesn't say.
It's the mini, the mini DSO. Yeah.
The mini DSO. Well, you can see, and man, it makes me wish I was back to aligning tape heads. Have something like that. It'd be so slick, wouldn't it? Instead of breaking out the big oscilloscope and finding a place to plug it in and getting those probes and
I might add, by the way, this is not a total replacement for a desktop oscilloscope.
Yeah, but if it samples good enough and it has a fast enough sweep, it could work just fine for things like aligning heads. I'm not saying you could necessarily troubleshoot an FM transmitter with it.
No, you could do a lot of repairs and troubleshooting, but yeah, it's limited.
The mini DSO, this is cool. I got to look into this.
Yeah, it's 72 megahertz inputs on it.
Okay.
That's not bad at all.
Yeah, that's it.
No.
It won't help you do the FM stuff, but it'll help you do certainly AM.
Oh, you can work with AM. You can work with audio. You can work with you can work with stuff up to 6 meters in the ham band.
Yeah, that's not bad.
Burke, I found it online at AliExpress for $168. Oh, plus shipping.
That's about it. Yeah, and it's the model is DS203.
Yep, that's what I'm looking at. That's very cool.
All right. Well, guys, we are out of time. We may be out of stuff to say, but we are out of time. I'm glad we got to cover this this interesting move at Harris. I think that, I mean, look, in the best scenario, a company who's really interested in maintaining and pushing ahead the product lines from Harris will come along and will purchase it from the now disinterested Harris Corporation, right? And I think that could be the best thing that could happen. If somebody wanted to come along and grab a couple transmitter companies, that might be a good thing too. We'll just have to wait and see. If you own a Harris transmitter, I think the consensus is not to worry. There's so many of them around the world. It's big business to maintain and support and supply parts for them. So, and there's a lot of knowledge about Harris transmission products all around the world since they have been so popular for decades that I don't think they're going away. Am I
probably
right?
Okay. Probably not.
There's a couple of big Harris transmitters just down the road from me at WSM. I think they'll be on the air for years. Guys, we got to go. Chris Tarr, any last words for us?
Nope, I'm good.
All right, good. Chris, thank you for being with us, by the way, Chris Tarr from Mukwonago, Wisconsin. I sure appreciate you. Be here next week, if you would, for Mr. Poray. He's going to, from SBE. And Chris Tobin from New York City, thank you very much for being with us from Manhattan.
Oh, you're welcome. And make sure you folks go out to your transmitter sites once a week and look for things that shouldn't be. You know, dirt around the fans and stuff like that.
Good advice. And if you just clean the transmitter, you'll find what's about to go wrong.
Oh, absolutely.
And
usually, yep.
And Tom Ray, thank you for being with us also from the Hudson Valley of New York City. I appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me. It's always a lot of fun.
Our sponsor has been...
I'm going to go look into my Harris transmitter right now.
Okay. Go look in on it. I was looking for my Harris. I have a hardback. Actually, it's a Gates Intertype Corporation catalog. I wish I had it for the show here. I couldn't put my hands on it just before the show. Hey, guys, thank you for joining us for This Week in Radio Tech. We got some great guests coming up in future weeks. So please tune in for that. We'll try to tweet that word out and let you know who and when, including I mentioned John Poray, but also a rep from ERI to help explain this idea of combining the HD signal and the FM signal with not very much loss at all. It's kind of magic, I think. It's just really incredible. We'll see you next week on This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye, everybody.